Touch me,
No,
it's
no,
so easy
no,
to
no.
leave
Play the
me.
theme. I'm not giving Andrew Lloyd Webber any money.
Linoleum knife.
A meow cast of the cinema.
Did I surprise you, meow?
Yeah. Meow was not
Were you
expecting that.
simultaneously shocked and delighted by my rendition of Memory from the musical, the hit musical, the internationally beloved musical,
Now and forever.
Cats?
I was
Were you?
shocked and horrified,
Listen,
perhaps might
I'm
be
a
the
very good
better.
singer. I think everyone can see it.
It's not a question of
Everybody can
you
hear
what
that.
your singing is
Everyone can
like,
hear
which
what a
is a
great
topic
singer
for
I
another
am.
day. It's just your choice of song.
Listen,
I've
that's
never
the
liked
song.
that song.
Why? What is wrong with you?
Ugh. That song, like it, the first time it came out of anyone's throat already felt like it had been beaten to the ground. Like some songs just like they
Yeah.
just you get sick of them very quickly.
Are you telling me that you don't like it when Betty Buckley has done that song in the cat outfit costume?
Look, she's a national
She's a national
treasure,
treasure,
but I don't
Betty
like that
Buckley.
song. I don't like that song. I love the joke in Jersey Girl, where the kid has like her class has a talent show with the parents, and it's all these like mothers and children doing Memory from Cats, and then she comes out with Ben Affleck to do God That's Good from Sweeney Todd. You're Dave White,
Sure.
and I'm Alonzo Duralde.
I'm Betty Buckley.
You
I think you
wish.
just heard me being her.
Yeah,
That was a
it's an eerie resemblance.
good
You're the
impersonation.
Beatlemania of Betty Buckley. This is a podcast about movies, and we're both film critics, and we're married to each other. And I'm a slightly low energy this week because I am smack in the middle of Outfest Los
All
Angeles.
your energy has gone to that film festival.
Yes.
Almost none of mine has.
Yes, I know. I'm constantly asked, are we going to see Dave? Is Dave here?
Oh,
Where
you
the
saw
hell's
Dave
Dave?
yesterday.
And I'm like, Dave showed up for one movie, and if you missed him, you missed
Yeah.
him.
Listen, this I'm the golden ticket of this Wonka mania. You see me? It's like sighting a rare bird. Like a gorgeous, beautiful, rare, exotic bird.
You're a fat unicorn.
Gorgeous, rare, exotic, unicorn, fat bird.
Yes.
Listen.
With the crystal plumage.
I didn't go to opening night.
Yeah.
But I did go to the documentary Queer Japan
Yes.
yesterday.
That our dear friend Graham Colbeans
Our wonderful
directed.
friend Graham Colbeans. This is his first feature
Yes, he's had
of
like
documentary. He's had
two
some
or three
shorts.
shorts at Outfest in the
Yes.
past.
And we've known him forever, and he is the designer of many of our Linoleum Knife
Yes.
logos and banners and
He
things.
is indeed.
And he had a documentary about queer culture in Japan that he's been working on for the past 4 years.
Yeah.
And it began because he had an interest in the gay erotic manga artist
Gengar
Gengar
Togami.
Otagame, and that led to co-editing a book of Takame's work, and then another book, and
And a clothing
a clothing
company.
company called Massive. Like, this is a, you know, he's young and ambitious.
Yes. He's a real go-getter.
So I was there for that yesterday, and I had already seen a rough cut of the film, but I saw the final cut yesterday. It's lovely. It's just a lovely movie, full of interesting people who do interesting things, and and a tone of exploration and enthusiasm, and it's wonderful.
I've gotten to do some really cool Q&As at the festival this year. Rodney Evans, a filmmaker whose work I've liked for a long time, he directed Brother to Brother and The Happy Sad, has a new documentary called Vision Portraits, which is about artists who are losing or have lost their eyesight but continue to create their art, including a photographer, a dancer choreographer, and a writer, because Evans is himself losing his eyesight.
Oh.
As a filmmaker, but continues to be a filmmaker. And this is a really fascinating piece. It's going to be opening in New York on August 9th at the Metrograph, and then here in Los Angeles at the Lemley Royal on August 23rd.
So it has a distributor. It's going
well.
Places.
He's getting it into theaters,
right?
But you know, I highly recommend that people go, especially because I think on both of those opening weekends he will be doing Q&As in those cities, and he's fascinating and just somebody I really always enjoy getting to catch up with. And then last night I did a Q&A for a narrative feature called Mother's Little Helpers, which I did not know the full backstory of this movie. Apparently, basically the director. She had this sort of family story that her husband had gone through when his father died, and sort of things they found out about the father after he died.
Right.
And she had access to like camera equipment and some other stuff for a couple of weeks. So she literally contacted all these actors that she knows and were like, be here Tuesday. We're going to start shooting.
Be here, ready to act.
And so like she had kind of an outline, but she's in the movie also, but she and the other cast members, including Melanie Hutzel, formerly of Saturday Night Live, basically improvised the whole thing. So sort of like what you hear about like Mike Lee's process where he works with the cast from sort of a skeleton of an idea and they add stuff to it.
Yes.
But they were doing it on the fly, like just making it happen. And it's an interesting movie. It's really good, I think. And
what's it called again?
Mother's Little Helpers. And she had an interesting point to make where she said, you know, a lot of times actors spend more time with the characters than the director does. The director is dealing with like, what's that truck doing over there? And are we losing the light? Like a million things that are going on.
Right.
And the actor just has nothing but that character to be working on for however weeks or months leading up to the thing.
Get that kid out of the shot.
Yeah. And so sometimes, you know, directors do not want to hear the actor's ideas at all.
Right.
And sometimes they'll do that thing of like, we're going to shoot it my way. And then if we have time at the end, you can do one, you know, with your crazy idea.
Right.
And she said, directors should let actors do their thing first. like just out the gate, let them go with it because they've been thinking about this more, and then guide that, and then, you know, like occupy the space between their idea and your idea and sort of move them toward what you want to do.
Okay,
but kind of let them go first. All which right. I thought was an interesting approach.
However,
I'm not saying it's...
What about that lady that was in Hurricane Heist? She didn't do any work with her character at
no,
all.
But she did. Her dress matched her gun, though.
I don't remember her name, but I will always remember her.
And her IMDb bio.
She's a very bad actress.
She was not good.
And did not do any preparatory.
True. Okay. So
not do any preparation.
It's a two-way street. And I'm reminded also of that documentary, Who is Henry Jaglom, where Martha Plimpton talks about how...
What about Henry Jaglom, who seemingly also does no work before turning his camera?
Martha Plimpton, she goes, you get on a Henry Jaglom set. He's like, just do whatever you want to do and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then you'll do it. And then he'll say, cut. He goes, okay, yeah, do whatever you want, but not that.
Right.
And then it just goes cut after cut after cut, but, you know, and he's like, she's like, he would just, instead of just telling you what he wants, he just figures it out by process of elimination of telling you everything that you are doing is wrong.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. So, you know, there are cases to be made on both sides here, but it was just interesting to hear it articulated that way. I'd never heard a filmmaker say that before.
Hurricane Heist.
Kestrin Pantera
everybody,
is her name.
Everybody see Hurricane,
Hurricane
Heist.
Heist. She is not in Hurricane Heist.
It has been brought to our attention that everybody wants us to talk about the Cats trailer.
Well, you know.
And normally y'all stay quiet. Honestly, normally y'all don't come to us and be like, talk about this.
Right.
And I think it's because you know that we'll just be like, no.
No.
We're going to do whatever we want.
Maybe if you sign up for our
Patreon.
We've
already beaten you down. Yeah. And We've already made you have no expectations. But everybody came this week and was like, can y'all please talk about the Cats trailer? And so we decided on two things. Number one, we're fixing to talk about the Cats trailer. Number two, and this is more of a heavy lifting exercise for me than it is for Alonzo, because Alonzo already covers trailers to some degree on the Breakfast All Day podcast.
Correct. I don't like watching trailers, but the Breakfast All Day subscribers literally pay us to watch them, so I watch them.
So here's what we're going to start doing. As you know, and this will suffice as an advertisement for our Patreon, as you know, we have a Patreon. Depending on the level of subscription, you get a certain amount of things in terms of extra content.
Mm-hmm.
You get a TV podcast called LKTV. You get a food podcast called Linoleum Knife and Fork. You get a podcast called Linoleum Nights if you subscribe at the toppity-toppest level. And on Linoleum Nights, we talk about anything we want, but primarily, you know, current events and stuff like that. We're going to start doing trailers on Linoleum Nights.
Mm.
So you're really going to have to love hearing people talk about trailers. Because again, it's the next to top level of subscription.
Yes.
Or
the top level.
But if you're just dying, well, the top level is restricted to a certain number of people.
Oh, that's true.
Because that involves a lot of merch that goes right out, and I just don't have the bandwidth to handle more than 80 folks at the top level. And I think we roughly have that number.
Yes, although generally speaking, when we lose one, we gain one.
There's always one spot opening up. Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. Linoleum Nights is now going to feature a weekly exploration of the art of film trailers. And you're welcome. Because as you may know, if you've listened to this show for any length of time, I don't watch trailers.
No. You live in a crazy, magical bubble of no entertainment news whatsoever.
It is the house that Jack built. I have constructed my existence in such a way as to not only avoid most trailers, and when I say that, I mean I go to the movie theater to watch a film, and I take a little nap during the trailers.
Mm.
I can go to sleep like that. Well, and I just close my eyes and I doze for 10 to 15 minutes, depending on how long they go. And I also have constructed my existence to avoid pre-release information of most types. I do not follow a lot of people on film Twitter who push hype material. And if they do too much of that, I mute them. And I do not go to the sites. I do not watch any of that stuff, really, ever, until after the fact.
You made a very valuable observation about trailers.
Yeah.
Which is that if you close your eyes,
yeah,
they all sound the same.
They do. They all go, they're all like,
yeah.
Or boom, you know.
Or it's like, boom, boom.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but you know, because I love you guys so much.
And your money.
Also that. If you subscribe at the Linoleum Knights level on patreon.com/linoleumknife, we're going to start talking about trailers. All right. Cats. Jellicle Schmellicle Cats.
This is the famous first one's always free.
Why don't you describe, Alonzo Duralde, your personal feelings about this trailer?
Whew. All right. Well, unlike you, I have never seen the stage show.
Oh, I have seen the stage show. It was the very first Broadway musical that I ever saw. And I didn't even see it.
You saw it on
Broadway.
On the West End.
I saw it in the West End, in London, the United Kingdom.
Ye olde London town.
In 1989, at its original, like, theater.
Production, yeah.
It had only been on, the stage for, like almost 10 years at that point.
Was it Covent Garden?
You know, I can't remember. Oh. But it was a big round theater that they had transformed entirely into the set. And the cats would come down into the audience and swing on things and stuff. It's crazy. And I saw it on a... on a matinee, on a weekday, like a Wednesday matinee. It was me and like a several hundred school children. Because by that point in the run, years into the run.
Right.
It was all a bunch of little kids. I had no idea. I was like, well, I guess I'm going to go see my first piece of musical theater ever in my life. I hear Cats is very popular. I'm going to go see that Cats show. I will tell you a thing. Had a great time.
Well, good.
It was fun. Those people in those cat costumes were delightful. They danced all over the place. That lady sang the memory song. The tire rose up. She went up to the
Kitty Heaven.
She went up to Kitty Heaven. Fantastic afternoon at the theater.
Was it Louis Vertel or somebody who described the plot as a bunch of cats introduce themselves and then decide which one gets to die?
Yes. Yes. And that's, I think that's what it's about.
So,
also,
yeah.
Also, T.S. Eliot was an anti-Semite.
Oh, well, that's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, these were poems that were written for children. And somebody dug up, I think it was Bibbs tweeted, an interview with Harold Prince, who, you know, after having done a lot of, like, Sondheim shows and whatnot, directed Cats. And he's talking about how, you know, so I went back and I read the poems and I was talking to Andrew Lloyd Webber and I said, so I guess, is this one cat supposed to be sort of like Queen Victoria? And then these other ones are, you know, Disraeli and Gladstone and blah, blah, blah. And Andrew Lloyd Webber was like, no, they're cats. And according to Harold Prince, and then we never discussed it again. So, yeah, apparently it's a show about cats. You know, and I know what the stage cats look like. I know what that crazy sort of theatrical makeup and costuming looks like. You know, I saw Jeffrey, you know, where Brian Batt plays somebody who's in the cast. And
right.
I have in-laws who were touring cats.
What?
One of my sisters married into a family in which her husband's...
I'm sorry, what?
How do you not know this?
I'm asking you that question. How do I not know this? I've been in this family for over 20 years.
Yes, my sister has in-laws, basically, who toured in Cats for several years.
Whose husband has the family of cats?
Victoria.
No.
Yes. Every time. That's why.
David has siblings?
A sibling and spouse who were...
No one has ever told me this.
How did you not know this?
Because, again, no one has told ever you. Told
okay,
me
well,
that.
It wasn't a secret or anything.
Oh, y'all act like it was a secret.
No, I just went... to this day, this happened. This was decades ago, and to this day, when my sister and I are talking about her in-laws, I say, oh, and how are the cats?
Did these conversations happen after 8:30 p.m.?
That might be it. That could be why you missed them.
I was very sleepy at that moment.
Well, now you have things...
probably already in bed.
Now you have things to bring up the next holiday.
So, David, tell me about the cats. Oh, I'm excited now. All right, go on.
Anyway.
This trailer is full of visual delights.
Oh, God, this trailer.
Oh, oh.
Okay. Now, again...
This trailer makes me want to start watching trailers again.
The stage cats had outfits and makeup and hair pieces and whatnot, you know, in a very sort of analog way.
Right.
This movie is giving us digital fur overlays.
Yeah.
So people are dancing around in, I guess, like little mocap ping pong ball outfits.
I suppose.
And having these, like, cat hair things on top of them. So you have, like, women with human breasts.
That's right.
But they're cats.
Oh, yeah.
And they're proportional cats in terms of the sets are all really big.
Yeah, it's so like they going to Mocha and standing under that big, not Mocha, it's like going to the Broad.
Yes.
And standing under that big table and chairs.
Exactly, yeah. So they're scampering under these giant beds. And
scampering is a good word.
And whatnot.
Undulating.
It all looks another good word. Just weirdly uncanny valley. And then most of them have faces that are their faces and you can recognize their faces. But like Jennifer Hudson, for some reason, has been given like stripes or something on her. Some cats
have
her face.
Some cats have stripy faces.
I understand. I understand bodies. That, but it.
She's going to be a stripy cat.
It looks strange, especially if they don't all have it.
Listen, everybody knows already in life, just from living their daily, day in day out lives, that digitally constructed cats look just like that. Come on now.
And then you've got some cats that
don't see why everyone's being so shocked.
Some cats are naked. Some cats wear clothes. Some cats wear what looks like to be the fur of other cats.
Well, these are the warrior cats. they've been out in it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
This just looks like
a trophy fur.
This looks like an amalgam of terrible ideas.
Oh, no.
And it is...
No.
If it were being directed by somebody...
Wonderful ideas.
If it were being directed by somebody who I was like, okay, yeah, let's all take that leap into the void together. Sure. I trust you. It's directed by Tom Hooper.
Yeah, whatever. Who cares?
Whose screen adaptation...
for Les Mis.
Of Les Miserables.
Listen, I get it.
Is one of the worst movies I have seen in my adult life.
All day long. I am in for this freak show.
I
cannot wait.
I will be there with cat bells on.
Oh, I cannot wait.
Because this promises to be a legendary catastrophe.
Time. Oh, we don't know. Maybe it will be a catastrophe that magically somehow like alchemizes itself into the spectacle of the century.
I can't even tell if you're kidding.
I can't either. What do I really feel? I don't know. All I know is that when I see a trailer like this, and when I hear Jennifer Hudson oversing for her life.
Ooh. I mean, she's talented.
A vibrato to shake a building.
She has been directed to Keen, practically.
I'm
singing here.
I have little, like, goosebumps. How badly do I want to see this? This could be legendary. This could be, like...
The apple?
It could be like the apple.
Yeah.
And think about how much you love the apple.
True.
Think about how everything in the apple is so wrong that it somehow turns itself inside out and becomes so right.
Right.
What if? What if? Listen, we all need to live in hope of something these days. It's a dark time in human history. I live in hope for this.
Believe me, my as horrified as I am by this trailer.
Out ends of smoky days.
My want to see is through the roof.
I'm going to the sing-along cats. Because you know they're going to have one.
Of course they are. God.
I'm a belt it out. Real loud.
Oh, God. And Ian McKellen and Judi Dench. Like,
Dame Judi Dench.
Dame Judi Dench. Dame Judi Dench. Dame Judi Dench. Dame Judi Dench.
She looks amazing. She's like 106. And she's like, yeah, put me in this damn thing.
I didn't get to be in the stage show because I snapped a tendon.
Make me a cat. Is that a real thing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, was she supposed to be in
She was supposed to be in the original, like, 1981 thing.
As good indication for Dame
playing Judi Dench. Two different cats.
Yeah.
And she snapped her Achilles tendon and
ready.
Had to drop. So
when is this? Why isn't this coming to theaters tomorrow?
Put it in my eyes.
I need it so badly. I don't want to die before then.
I don't want that either.
I don't want Trump to destroy the world before then. I mean, I don't want him to do it ever, but like, yeah, let's face it, he could do it at any moment.
Mm.
And he's crazy enough to try it.
There are moments in the trailer where I felt like I was watching Kate Bosworth's face float in front of an actual surfer in Blue Crush.
I'm going to tell you something about Blue Crush in that moment where she's on the surfboard.
Yeah.
And you see her face hovering, weirdly hovering over the body and face of another person. Like, they hadn't got the technology down there. What else do you remember about Blue Crush?
Somebody pooped on the floor of a hotel room. That's literally the only other thing
I don't remember that about Blue Crush at all. All I remember is that moment and feeling the thrill of existence. Knowing that I was experiencing a first in cinema.
Okay, but what if Cats is less Blue Crush and more Mars Needs Moms?
Well, then I'll be very disappointed. It'll be a bleak Christmas.
Yes.
It is coming out for Christmas,
right? It is coming out for Christmas.
What a gift. What a gift for all of us.
I hope that I hope they're we're showing it to the critics groups early, because, you know, we vote earlier than that in the month. If they don't, it means they're giving it the Holmes and Watson treatment, which is we're releasing it so late in the year that by that time, most people will have already written their worst
lists.
Here's
what this trailer has done. Given them all the advertising they wanted.
Oh, yeah.
People are showing
up. We're all talking about
it. People are showing up for this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm right there.
Well, and, you know, and here's my segue. They launched the trailer.
I don't even want to be around a bunch of critics when I see it. I want to be in an audience.
With the people.
I want there to be an audience of cats.
Of school children.
Actual cats. I want to see it with real cats.
You would die of
it. I know I would die. I would end up in the ER and be actually dead.
But it's fascinating that they released it this week because, you know, it's next to impossible to not talk about Cats in terms of The Lion King.
Which I refuse to see.
Yes.
Because here's the thing
about
that.
You lazy, terrible person.
No, I'm not lazy. I'm taking a stand for cinema. Unlike Cats, which looks delirious. Every piece of information that I've received about The Lion King, both visual and, you know, secondhand from people who've seen it, makes me understand it to be the opposite of delirious, but more like tedious. And I know that you saw it.
Yes.
And that you have been encouraging me to see it because you hate me.
I mean, yes, but...
Because you want to punish your spouse, the man you claim to love more than anyone else in this entire world.
No, I want to hear your feedback.
Well, I have a series of interview questions for you regarding this film. And before you talk about what actually happens, I need confirmation. Yay or nay.
Well, what I want to say first is that one of my favorite tweets of late was that somebody said, like, Lion King and Cats are on opposite ends of a graph, but I don't know what that graph measures. And it's true. It's like, yes, they're antipodes, but I can't. But of what? I don't even know how to say what
I'll tell you already
what
what that graph measures.
Uh-huh.
Wacky pleasures versus go do your homework. This is a chore. On the one side is a chore that you have to do and endure. Please go mow the lawn. There's a lion out there. It's going to sing a song at you. Meanwhile, you have to mow the lawn. And on the cat's end, it's, would you like to do some drugs? They're fun.
You'll see cats sing.
You'll see cats singing. A lot of them. And then they're going to float up to kitty heaven. So that's the thing. Is it a chore or is it like a groovy, like,
trip?
Be in.
All right. Okay.
Here are my questions for you.
Let's have the questions before I say anything.
I went to see the original Lion King in 1974, 84, 94, whenever four it was. I was 29 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I was a grown-ass man already.
Yes. Ditto.
Born in 1964.
You were 30.
I was the beginning of Gen X, just FYI. Anybody who's out there being Gen X, you answer to me. I'm the OG Gen X. I was born in the first era, the first year when you could honestly say, you know, that you pretty much could be one. You
Yeah,
know,
we're old
those
Xers. If
60 to 65 is like the cusp era,
years,
like
yeah.
depending on who you were, where you were, what your older siblings were like, if you had any older
Older
siblings,
siblings.
how you were raised, what pop culture you had an affinity for. You were like the cusp people, like
Like
60 to 65.
I've been
Douglas
listening.
Copeland, who wrote the novel Generation X,
Was born in 61,
was born
right?
in like 60 or 61.
Yeah.
And so you, when you're OG Gen X, when you're the oldest of the Gen Xers, you have some authority and some seniority. And I'm
No,
here to tell
no
you
question.
that we didn't give a damn about The Lion King,
Exactly.
except for Matt Zoller Seitz, who is our friend, but whom I did not know at that time. I didn't know who he was. I was just reading him in the
Yes.
Dallas Observer.
Right.
And that melon farmer wrote a review of The Lion King, essentially calling it a masterpiece. And I was like, well, I trust this dude. I really love his writing. I love his reviews. I believe him when he tells me things. I'm gonna go see this movie. I saw it late in the run too, because I was really dragging my feet. Then it was over at Jennifer's, and they had a stack of Dallas Observers, and I was just reading through it. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna go. I'm gonna go. And I saw it, and I was like, yeah, this was fine. It looked really wonderful. Animation was gorgeous,
Yeah.
especially the early sequences, like the Circle of Life thing and the that whole Busby Berkeley
All right.
style. Was that during Circle of Life, or was that during I Can't Wait to Be King?
That's I Can't Wait to Be King.
Okay. A beautiful looking film
Yes.
with a story that I just did not give one damn 2 cents about.
Yeah, I
Because you know what? I already knew about Joseph Campbell. And it was not interesting to me to
yeah, I
watch this
was
little lion
be the reluctant warrior,
be the
blah blah
reluctant
blah.
warrior. I'm the reluctant hero. And
I was 27.
yeah.
I think I went to the press screening like at the El Capitan because I was living
Right.
here at the time.
Yeah.
And then yeah, I saw it once. I was like, it's no Beauty and the Beast,
Right.
and never thought about it again.
I did not think about it again until I started making friends with millennials who would report to me.
Weaned on that film.
One of them, who actually may be listening right now, watched it 55 times on
Oy.
VHS cassette as a child, over and over and
Yeah.
over and over again. This movie means nothing to me. So, does this new, do we call it live action?
No, I'm not.
Does
I
this new
refuse to call
one,
it. It is an it, this is animation.
does
Come
this new
on.
one have the big Busby Berkeley style number?
Nope.
Well, then strike one. Is, well, no, the rest, part B of my question was, is Beyonce in the center of it, perching atop the circle of life?
Oh no.
Strike one and a half.
This is a movie that is in desperate need of a matriarchy.
Number two.
Like actual lions have.
Does this film have a surprise twist ending that makes Beyoncé Lion the queen rather than that annoying boy lion?
No.
Nope. Strike two and a half. Is this as entertaining as the Beyoncé film Obsessed?
Oh, God, no.
Strike three and a half. Does Beyoncé sing Formation?
No.
Does she eat an entire giraffe?
No.
Is anything happening that's good when Beyoncé is not on screen being a lady lion?
There's really not that much good happening when she is on screen being a
That makes
lady
me very sad.
lion.
Strikes five, six, seven and a half. I noticed in the IMDb page that there are a lot of people I really like doing voices. Eric Andre, Amy Sedaris, John Oliver, Seth Rogen, and Billy Eichner. As the Hakuna Matatas, what are their names?
Timon and Pumbaa.
Timon and what is it?
Timon,
Timon and Pumbaa.
the meerkat
I just
and
call them the Hakuna Matatas.
yes, and
Do they sing
Pumbaa the
Do they
they
sing
do
Hakuna?
sing
They do
Hakuna
sing
Matata.
Hakuna
Come
Matata.
on, they know where their
Listen,
bread
I
is
don't know
buttered.
any. Come on, if they're not going to do the thing where all the animals are spinning around like you know some old Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney musical,
Right.
then I'm not like what. What's in it for me? I need to know what's in it for me.
it's worth it. I wanted you to see it to sort of fully analyze the wrongheadedness of the whole adventure.
Well, I can guess what the wrongheadedness is just from never having seen it at all. A, pointlessness. What compelling artistic reason is there to create this movie?
Well, here's the thing.
Yes.
You saw Jungle Book.
I did.
You liked Jungle Book?
It was fine, yeah.
Yeah, I liked Jungle Book. I thought it was interesting.
It was also substantially different.
Yes.
From the animated feature.
It is a film that was embraced by Gen Xers, but not by the internet millennials.
Right.
So we could go into a Jungle Book remake and not be angry that they didn't, like, completely mimic every shot of the film.
I don't like it when they mimic.
Well, they do that a lot.
Unless
in this
it's Gus Van Sant's Psycho, which I think is funny and strange.
I'm glad you brought that up because this is the Gus Van Sant's Psycho
for him being weird like that
of Disney cartoons and not trying to do what Van Sant was doing, but just because like, looky, we can do this thing.
Like, there's an artist I really loved. She's gone now. Elaine Sturtevant, who used to do doubles of other people's artwork.
So she was a forger.
No, you don't get it. Like a sort of, you know, mimetic exercise.
I see.
And so she would do work that was identical to other artists, other contemporary artists. And that was her entire career. She was really cool.
Well, this
there
is
are an entire list of reasons why she did these things. You know, she had ideas about, you know, what made something original and what was the idea of you know, authorial intent and stuff like that.
Sure.
This is theoretical ideas. Okay. Played out in her work. Exciting. I don't feel excitement about this.
No, it's not exciting at all.
Yeah.
It is deadly. Because, for one thing, the whole old Xer thing has definitely been, I've been thinking about of late because I've been listening, I've been catching up with the new podcast Waiting to Exhale.
Yes.
Hosted by our lovely friends, yes, Karen Tonks and Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh.
Have you read Why Karen Carpenter Matters? By Karen Tonkson. That's a book you should get.
You ought to should read it.
I'm reading it right now in little bits and pieces right before screenings start.
And I'm waiting for you to finish the damn thing so I can read it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyway, the show is, from a Gen X perspective.
Right.
But their Gen X is
they're
not
younger
quite
than
the
we
same
are
as our Gen
they're
X.
They're all younger than
we got a good decade on both of them, at least.
I think
and so
Karen's in her 40s and Winter's almost 40.
Yeah.
Is that roughly approximately true?
Yeah. Okay. So they are children of the 80s in the way that we are children of the 70s.
Correct. Yes.
Even though we are both all technically
Xers. We're all technically part of the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, this movie.
Generations are a lie. I just needed to say that.
Yeah.
As well. Go on.
So this movie, I think whereas, again, Jungle Book didn't feel like it needed to recreate these you know, famous shots or whatever.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the animals felt like they had more expressive faces and could express more emotion. And there was at least one human being in the film for them to sort of respond to. Here you have these creepily photorealistic. It's like the kind of thing you would see in a, like the Mike, you know, where they make the camel talk in that commercial.
Is that a Geico commercial?
I don't remember. I'm not sure.
Mike. Movie day.
Yeah.
I love that commercial.
But, you know, like lion's faces,
yeah,
there's just so much you can do.
Yeah.
You know, and no matter how hard Seth Rogen is really, like, pushing the comedy,
right,
it is coming out of the face of a warthog.
Right.
An actual warthog.
Right.
You know, so it's like he and Billy Eichner.
But it's a digital warthog. It's
yes, of course. But I'm just saying, but it is behaving, it is rendered like an actual warthog.
Okay.
So its face doesn't do a lot. So as much as, like, Billy Eichner and Seth Rogen are really trying to, like, wacky it up and be all vaudevillian and whatnot.
Yeah.
The faces that they're coming out of are so flat and expressionless and just not compelling that it all becomes this weird sort of emotional uncanny valley where we're supposed to, like, you know, think that these animals are saying, and, you know, I mean, John Oliver is a bird, you know, and this clacking beak and these eyes,
right.
There's not a lot of humanity to it, right. Which is just weird. I talk on Breakfast All Day about how, you know, you can come up with this amazing new cinematic technology, but you have to use it for the right movie. You know, like Avatar became a hit because the 3D was so immersive and yes. It kind of put you into that world.
Right.
The Walk was a flop because they did an incredibly realistic job of showing you what walking on a tightrope between the Twin Towers was like, but audiences did not want to experience that particular thing in a realistic way.
Now, there's one that I did go to, the press screening with you, and the entire walk sequence, I put
your hands on your eyes.
I closed my eyes. I could not bear to see it. My fear of heights is so great. Fear of flying, equally great. Distaste for 9/11, which I think most people have. I think most people have that distaste.
Yeah, I'd say if you have a taste for 9/11, you should get help.
I knew that if I did not close my eyes, I was going to have a panic attack, and so I closed my eyes during that whole sequence. Yeah. And anyone who asked me about it, I said, "Well, here's why I did not want to watch the last 15 minutes of this movie."
No, it's an extraordinary segment. I have issues with other parts of the movie, but like that segment is brilliant.
Well, the rest of the movie is just terrible and boring, anyways.
Yeah, but it is brilliant at doing a thing that audiences did not want to experience or look at. And I feel like the Lion King, even though it's a pre-sold success.
It made a
bajillion dollars this weekend.
A lot of them. A lot of dollars.
Because people love the original one. But like in 6 months from now, a year from now, I don't think anybody's going to look at this movie with the same affection that they have for the first one. They're going to look at this one as sort of a souvenir of the first movie. This is the Disney on Ice version of the first movie. And so it's like, yes, you have all these amazingly photorealistic animals that you can animate in a way that they look real and they move real, blah, blah, blah. But that doesn't serve The Lion King, the musical.
Right.
You know, and then just also weird decisions like, can you feel the love tonight being sung in the middle of the afternoon? I can't even.
Can you feel the afternoon delight?
Yeah, there we go. But, you know, Beyonce and Donald Glover, both really, you know, magnetic performers, but they are both stuck in these lion faces that don't do anything, you know. It's even like, you know, Idris Elba's Be Prepared isn't nearly as fun.
Oh, yeah, I had another question. Is the villain gay?
Not particularly.
The Scar.
Yeah,
he was real gay.
Yeah, but again, you know
what? You know what? I like a gay villain. I've always loved a gay villain.
Do you know why Scar got to be gay? Because he had like an upper lip and eyebrows. Mm. And he like there were they had faces then. And this is just this mangy old lion looking like a mangy old lion.
Now, Obsessed had a good gay villain.
He was more of a henchman.
Doesn't matter. He was gay and he was villainous.
Fine.
And that means, again, that you should watch Obsessed instead of The Lion King.
If you really want to support Queen Bey.
You want to support Beyonce and gay villainy.
Gay villainy.
Nothing like a treacherous gay.
Wait, who's the dude in Obsessed?
Idris Elba.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes. Yes, okay.
And under normal circumstances, that would be the selling point of the film.
Right.
But it is not.
No.
The selling point of the film is Beyonce.
Yes.
And that treacherous gay.
Mm-hmm. And Beyonce catfight.
And Beyonce having a big throwdown fight at the end of the movie.
And Idris Elba soon to be seen in Cats.
So it all comes into some sort of weird version of a circle.
Everybody's off doing their own Misbegotten musical.
Listen, I have no regrets of not paying $18 to go see this movie.
Okay.
Because, y'all, that's how much a ticket to the Arclight and the Grove costs in Los Angeles. $18, depending on the time of day you go.
You could have gone to a matinee at the Century City.
I could have gone to a matinee at the Century City for about $9.
Yes.
Still, though.
I know.
Time. I have a lot. Listen, I don't have a lot of time. I like to spend my time on cinema, as you know.
Oh.
Would you like to hear about me and cinema?
Oh, this please. Week? I live for it.
I would love to tell you all about it. I saw two films that you did not see. So this is that weird episode, and we've done about three or four of these over the past 9 years.
Sure.
Episodes where you see something and I see other things, and we don't see the same thing together. We're just reporting. I saw Rojo. R-O-J-O.
Right.
Red
in Spanish.
An Argentine film by Benjamin Neistat. I don't know how to say his name perfectly, but that is how you say his name. He has two earlier features. One is called El Movimiento, the movement.
Mm-hmm.
The other is called The History of Fear. I haven't seen his two earlier films.
Did they get released?
Now that I've seen Rojo, I'm going right back to watch these other two movies because this guy is doing something. It is a film set in Argentina in 1975. Now, here's what you ought to know. In 1976, a military dictatorship took over, into power, and they lasted for about 7 years. And they were bad. They were fascists, and they were bad.
Mm-hmm.
And they, over the course of that time, eliminated 30,000 people from the Argentine population.
That's where the term disappeared comes from.
That is where the term disappeared comes from. They had them disappeared.
Yes.
These were people that they considered to be enemies of the regime. Very much like what the current American president regime is trying to do to anyone who isn't white and on their team. So this is what really happened in Argentina, if you don't know about that. This takes place in a sort of province of Argentina. And the film begins with a very strange scene. There is a well-regarded lawyer eating dinner alone in a restaurant. And he's waiting for his wife to show up. He's ordered, but he's not eating yet. I shouldn't say he's eating dinner alone, but he's waiting for his wife. And a sinister-looking, angry-looking man shows up, stands in front of the table, and begins demanding that he be given that table because the party is incomplete at that table. So he should be able to sit down and begin his meal rather than the lawyer. And he makes enough of a stink about it that the lawyer stands up and says, "Go ahead, take the table." But then the lawyer stands next to the table and begins sort of very coldly eviscerating this guy with the things he says about your upbringing is terrible, you're ill-mannered, you're a scared, fearful little man, and you don't know how the world operates, and blah, 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 blah. And then the guy who took the table from the lawyer goes ballistic, starts screaming about Nazis, and tries to tear the restaurant apart. And then you don't understand why that happened for a long time in this film.
Hmm.
You realize that the possible villain in this scene might not be the guy who tried to tear apart the restaurant. It might be the lawyer. Because at first you're on the lawyer's side. You're thinking, yeah, what a jerk. Like, who do you think you are coming in here and telling me to stand up and give you a table? So then we follow the story into what amounts to white-collar crime.
Okay.
There's a house that has been mysteriously abandoned, and a friend of the lawyer's wants to buy the house. But the house isn't on the market yet. He wants to go under the radar, snap up the house, mm-hmm. and he wants the lawyer to help him. And he wants to set up this sort of proxy guy who's like a dummy, you know, buyer, and it's all a scheme.
Right.
Right. There's a scheme in place. And what you realize over the course of this film, with this white-collar crime taking place, and Americans showing up in Argentina for reasons unknown, The lawyer's daughter involved in a ballet recital that is sort of about the colonial history of Argentina. An eclipse that takes place that turns everything red for a few moments.
Hence the title.
Hence the title. And you begin to realize that this is a mysterious, sort of ominous film about what happens when the world begins to unravel. And you and I have been watching the British TV series Years and Years each week, and that show depicts a family that is in the process of watching the world unravel between the years 2019 and 2030 something. And it speeds forward very quickly, and it's not subtle. It's like it is, this that's a TV show that is like a big clanging alarm, right? This is different.
And yet feels like a documentary.
And yet it feels like a documentary. This is different. This is a movie about the past as it really happened. And it's about the quiet beginnings of fascism and what happens to respectable bourgeois people during that time and how they participate or look the other way or get in on the getting while the getting's good, set themselves up to ride out whatever bad is coming. It's a film where everything feels like everything's about to go wrong very quickly. Everything is not res everything, every plot line is not neatly tied up. Every character is not exactly who they seem to be. People you think are good are not good. People you think are like terrible, weird, narcissistic, opportunists definitely turn out to be that. But it's a feeling that leaves you with this weird rumbling in your stomach, like, oh. This Argentine movie needs to be seen by so many people, and yet so many people are not going to see this film because it is in Spanish and it's getting a very small art house release, and yet it is so very timely. It reminds me in a way, although not exactly, of the film that came out earlier this year called Transit, about people who have to run from the fascists who have just taken power.
Based on a novel that was set during World War II, but feels super timely now.
And the film is set now. But this one's different. This one is set in a historical setting that really took place, that is a warning for the United States.
Well, and I mean, fascism, it's not just American anymore. I
No,
mean,
it's not. It's taking place all over the world now. Far right governments are rising in power, and it's absolutely terrifying. And so, if you get a chance, definitely go see this movie. It's something special and unsettling and mysterious, and deserves to be seen on a big screen if you can get to one where it's playing. Like, it's currently playing in Los Angeles, and also New York, and whoever knows where else. But like, go find it on a website somewhere. Whoever's distributing it will probably have a list of cities that it's going to play in. It's called Rojo, Rojo. Definitely try to check it out. It's one of the better films I've seen this year so far.
Cool.
I also saw Ray and Liz, and I reviewed it for the Wrap. So if you go to the Wrap and you want to read my review, you can do that. Ray and Liz is the first feature by an artist named Richard Billingham. He became well known ish, I guess, in the art world. In 1997, he was part of the Sensation exhibition. Now, if you don't remember that, that was the one where Chris Ofili had a portrait of the Virgin Mary that he had constructed, and it employed as media in the piece elephant dung, and it offended a lot of people, and
Who totally didn't understand the
who didn't
context of
understand
it.
anything about anything. Anyway, Richard Billingham had a series of photographs in the Sensation show. And they were photographs of his mother and father and younger brother. He grew up outside of Birmingham, England, in a council flat, mm-hmm. right? Which is sort of like a welfare, sort of public housing kind of yeah. place. And his father was an alcoholic. His mother was neglectful, disinterested. So he and his little brother, they kind of fended for themselves a lot. And over the years, he took their photographs. And the photographs were in that show, and then they were collected into a book called Ray's a Laugh. Ray is a Laugh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this feature is the fictionalized narrative version of those photographs. The actors in this film look just like his parents.
Mm.
As I went and looked at the photos after, I was like, oh my God.
Where do they find you?
Where do they find you? And these are established some yeah. British actors who've done a lot of TV and stuff. It's a tough movie. Not because it's loud or violent or excessive in any way. It's very quiet. It reminds me a lot of, and I said this in the review, Terrence Davies' The Long Day Closes, which mm-hmm. is also about a child's memory of his growing up years. But The Long Day Closes is not a film about trauma necessarily. It's about, you know, it's about poverty, but it's also about, you know, this boy's loneliness in a family that did take care of him.
I recall it having some darker aspects, but
it's been decades
since I've seen
but
it.
But there's, you know, violence and neglect taking place
right.
in this story. It's a very quiet movie. There are elements in terms of its execution. There are elements of slow cinema, I would say,
mm-hmm.
but not in a way that would make you feel like, oh my, what have I signed up for? Because I know that bothers a lot of people, the long, long takes and the static cameras and stuff like that. Some folks just ain't down.
Mm.
And it's not dour, and it's not an act of vengeance.
Mm.
It's not, look how crappy my parents were to me, and you know, I survived, and aren't I great? It's not. It's not that kind of story. It's very moving, and heart-stoppingly sad, but not for reasons you expect. He brackets each sequence in the film with shots of the elderly version of Ray, the father,
right.
alone in his apartment, and he's in bed, and he only ever really gets up to drink more so he can stay drunk. And he's, you know, in his 60s or 70s. The bulk of the film takes place in the 1980s, when the characters of the kids are very young. But the bookend sequences are really extraordinary because you realize that Ray has now been left alone by everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And near the end, you see Liz return. And she's no longer with him. They may still be married, but that's unclear. But she's certainly not living with him.
Right.
And, you know, it's like 30-something years later.
Mm.
She sits on his bed, and he looks at her, and he says, it's your fault that I'm this way. And she says to him, well, look what you've done. What kind of life is this that you've done for yourself? And it feels like the very first time they've ever said these things to each other. Like they've been decades together, right? And then she leaves him again. She walks out the door.
Hmm.
And he's left sort of mouthing along the words to an old Dusty Springfield song. Hmm. And it's devastating. There's so much in the filmmaking here that is, you know, compassionate. So many extreme close-ups. Like, it's as though Richard Bellingham is still trying to figure out why his parents were that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every neglected child wonders why. Every child who has suffered neglect wonders why their parents could not or would not take care of them properly, would not or could not love them properly. And sometimes you get an answer, and sometimes you never get an answer. And it's as though with this sort of very intimate, intense, up-close sort of camera work, because he's a photographer,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's like he's trying to dig in somehow to figure out what happened. To
take an x-ray.
With these people. And it becomes a very forgiving, compassionate film. It becomes an act of forgiveness.
Hmm.
And of course, you know, I only cry at horse movies.
Generally speaking, yes.
I will confess, this one made me cry.
Hmm.
And it was a tough review to write. Because of that.
And I had assigned it to you because this is a movie that has its roots in the world of contemporary arts.
Which, yes. And that you...
Not because I wanted to force you to watch another traumatic film about bad parenting.
Yeah, I had no idea what I was getting into because I knew about The Sensation Show.
Mm-hmm.
But The Sensation Show was really heavily weighted toward the YBAs, the young British artists
mm-hmm.
at the time. Damien Hirst and Tracy Emin and people like that. And Billingham was not really part of their crew. Like, he was in that show, but he didn't get a lot of press. The photos got a lot of press.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't become a star.
Right.
You know, he's a working artist, and he's always been working. And his work is in big collections all over the world. But, you know, Jeff Koons is a star.
Sure.
Right. But you know what I'm saying.
Yes. No, I,
and so I wasn't fully aware of his work. Hmm. You know, it's like there are too many bands in the world. There are too many TV shows to watch.
Right.
There are too many artists to pay attention to. And I was pretty new to him. And I looked up everything he did and figured out what this all was, you know, a piece of. And I recommend this film because it's one of the most moving, emotionally, you know, substantive films that I've seen this year.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly one of the best pieces of filmmaking that I've encountered so far this year. My experience is entirely subjective. But I have a good friend who asked me about this. And this good friend, this friend's childhood makes my run-of-the-mill neglectful childhood look, you know, like the Partridge Family. And I said, are you in a place where this kind of thing can bounce off you? Because if you're not, then you don't want to watch this movie. And he goes, nothing ever bounces off of me. I'm going to go rent it right now. So he doesn't
live because he's in the UK.
He lives in England. And
it's only just now getting to theaters.
It opened in March in the UK. It opens here now.
Yeah.
And he came back a couple hours later. He's like, yeah, that was great. And here's how it was exactly like my childhood. I was like, oh, God. So, recommend with a warning.
Sure.
It'll put you through the ringer. Well, any old way, it'll put you through the ringer. But in a very quiet, restrained way.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a DVD pick?
Could we call it a pick if I think it's a chore?
Well, if you're recommending it, it's a pick.
I'm recommending it as a time capsule. I'm recommending it as, and I haven't even said the name of the movie yet, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice.
Ah, yes.
I watched that the other night on the Criterion Channel because I had never seen it. 1969, the year of, you know, Easy Rider and all that. It was one of those zeitgeist.
It was a new Hollywood kind of film.
Mod. It was, you know, Paul Mazursky.
Yeah.
Jeez. For those of you who don't know, it is a comedy drama about two married couples, Robert Culp and Natalie Wood,
mm-hmm.
or Bob and Carol. Ted and Alice are Elliot Gould and the wickedly cool Diane Cannon.
Yes.
All right. So.
Late 60s, early 70s is peak Diane Cannon.
Yeah. They are two married couples who are in their 30s and exploring their feelings.
Well, not so much Ted and Alice. They're fairly conservative.
Yes, but they get suckered into it too.
Sure.
Alongside. So it begins with Bob and Carol going to a weekend encounter group where they, you know,
shed their inhibitions.
They shed their inhibitions and they learn to look into each other's eyes and look into the eyes of a stranger, really see the other person. You know, be emotionally vulnerable and real and don't cop out, man. You can make a drinking game out of the number of times that these characters use the expression cop out. That's a cop out, man. You're copping out. And every time they say it, and each time they say it, it's like a mountain of fakery that I hear every time I hear someone in their 30s or 40s or 50s try to use young people's slang.
But does the movie know this?
It's something that I have spent my adult life trying to shed myself of doing, because sometimes young people's slang becomes part of the culture.
Yes.
And you just start saying it. And
you are twerking on Fleek.
For example, if you are twerking on Fleek. Anyway, if you've never heard us say that before, it's because you haven't been listening for years and years and years. Anyway.
Does the movie know that they are being ridiculous older people who should not be appropriating the lingo, or is the movie just think this is how people, this is how we talk now?
If Paul Mazursky is making a pointed sort of critique about the banality of these people, I think that he could have critiqued a little harder, because what I really think is what he did was he made a movie about people trying to figure out how to keep in touch with the times.
Yeah.
But who learn at the end of the film that they are really just sort of old-fashioned. And the movie loves that they're old-fashioned.
Well,
I
haven't seen this movie in years, but I remember being disappointed when I finally did see it, because it is held up as this sort of paragon of the era. There is a thing that is a constant in Hollywood movies that drives me crazy, which is whenever there is a movie that is about any kind of violation of heteronormativity,
right?
Whether it's about a suburban couple that decides to swing, whether it's about somebody going and doing something that they shouldn't be doing, or that they've been told not to, that's some sort of taboo, the movie will either invariably let them off the hook before it actually has to happen.
Hump Day, a film by Lynn Shelton, which is a lot of jive-ass nonsense.
The Sleepover, another one that does
also
that.
Also The Sleepover,
or if it even starts to happen,
right,
they get punished like that.
Right.
And that drives
all Tyler Perry films.
That drives me up the wall. And yeah, this movie is definitely guilty of that. So yeah, check out Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. If you have a different take on it,
tell you
let
why
us
you
know.
Should watch it. Here's why you should watch it. Furniture, outfits,
dashikis,
Diane Cannon. Rolling her eyes through the first 50% of the movie. In the way that only she could do in that era.
Yeah. Like, Diane Cannon, like, watch Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, Such Good Friends, Doctor's Wives,
right.
The Last of Sheila.
Yeah.
Delicious Diane Cannon. She's the best.
But everybody else in the film is a square, and the movie, I think, lets them all off the hook and kind of congratulates them for it at the end. And maybe I'm reading it wrong, because I was only 5 years old in 1969 and I had no clue that any of this was happening outside in the world.
No, I think a lot of studio movies about the counterculture exist to sort of let audiences off the hook about not being in the counterculture.
Right.
For sure.
No, that's actually true. I wish I knew the intent of Paul Mazursky on this film. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because I haven't done enough reading or research on this particular film. I'm coming off it like 3 days ago from having seen it. I don't want to state, you know, unequivocally that I know what Paul Mazursky was going for.
Sure.
But it sure does feel like he was going for, you know, it's okay if you just want to be, you know, monogamous and uncool. It's fine.
Don't let those hippies tell you.
You don't have to have really awesome group sex. You don't have to do that.
If you have other thoughts on this movie, let us know at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
If I'm completely wrong, someone please tell me.
Pass me the top of that stack there, please.
No.
So there is a new steel book, if you're the kind of person that collects that sort of thing. You know, I do love me some physical media. I don't really care so much about the packaging. But there's a beautiful new steel book of Mothra.
Yep.
And I wanted to point it out as a pick because it has both the Japanese and U.S. versions, one of which is 11 minutes longer. So if you're a fan of that. Also, this version features an audio commentary with Steve Reifel and Ed Godsuzuski. Steve Reifel is a friend of ours. His wife, Joelle Ryan, has been on the podcast before. And the two of them wrote a really definitive biography of director Ishiro Honda and you know, who is the guy behind Godzilla and Mothra and a lot of like the great sort of Toho monster movies. So I have not listened to this commentary yet, but I know they know their subject and they're really interesting guys. So I look forward to an evening where we curl up with the Mothra commentary, Dave.
I'm ready.
Yes. So people should check that out.
I'm ready.
We have a letter.
Hello. Says Ruben, who also includes their pronouns as they, them.
Yes. Good to know. Y'all, start including your pronouns in things so that it just becomes a thing that everybody does and not, it's not this onus that is placed upon people who are non-binary or in any way gender variant.
Are you scolding me? Is that what you're doing right now?
No.
Not picking up a button from Outfest?
Wow. Yesterday? Well, if you feel scolded... That's on you.
They had pronoun buttons yesterday, and I was like, I don't wear buttons. I was like, I don't want a button.
Anyway, if you can put it in your,
and
you
you're
know.
You're like, oh, you should have a button. Like all these people are standing around. Why don't you get a button, Dave? I have a button. Look at my button. It's my button. Here are my pronouns. He, him, his. And I was like, I don't like buttons. I don't want to wear a button.
I was not
interested in having a button.
Frankly, I wasn't thinking about you and the button at all, but
I think you're scolding
me. You raise a valid point. I'm just saying for our listeners,
yes.
Please start putting it in your email sig. Start putting it in your Twitter bio. Just use it because, you know, even if you are the reigning king or queen of cisgenderness, it's a thing that we should all do.
Long time listener, first time emailer. I really love your podcast. And I recently, yesterday, late last night, watched some movies for the first time in half a year while ironing.
Oh.
It may have been longer than a year, even. I have ADHD, unmedicated, woohoo! And I have a beach of a time actually sitting down and focusing on movies. So, really, I have two questions. Dave, do you have some tips for ironing? And do y'all have any recommendations for movies that don't require too much attention? I tried watching a horror movie last night, and though it was riveting, it didn't go so great with the whole finishing my ironing before 1 a.m. thing. Thank you for the great podcast, Ruben. You're both very sweet.
Oh.
And I hope your day goes swimmingly.
Well, thank you, Ruben.
Ruben, I'm going to tell you all about ironing. If you can avoid it, avoid it. If you can get your shirts out of the dryer. If you can get your shirts out of the dryer before they wrinkle and get them on a hanger.
Slap them on a hanger.
You won't have to iron them.
Gravity will do it for you.
But if you're stuck in the position of ironing, as I often am, because my husband goes out to the world and presents himself as a spectacle, sometimes on stage, sometimes on screen.
Mm. As a fancy man.
As a fancy man in a fancy iron shirt. Ooh, and do check him out on CNN's The Movies.
Please do.
The 5 or 6 episode special.
Six.
Six episode special that's on CNN Sunday nights. The first two episodes, I have not been all that excited by because you're only in each episode once.
Mm.
But last night, I fast-forwarded through the whole thing just to get to you, and you are in it four different times.
True.
This Very is
the,
exciting.
The 2000s and beyond episode.
And I ironed the living hell out of that shirt.
Three times.
And I took notice of other men on camera whose shirts were not as impeccably ironed well, as yours.
They do not have you in I their bullpen.
You should listen, I'll take in laundry for money. I'll do anything for money. I'll iron your clothes.
And my diet pill is wearing off.
Who needs their ironing done? I'm good. I was watching Martha Stewart one day.
Oh, God.
And she was conducting a symposium on ironing.
Those poor lackeys.
Those interns.
Oh.
She was going from ironing board to ironing board.
Judging
and providing notes on their ironing technique. And she literally said to someone, I turned the shirt inside out and ironed the inside of it. And then I turned the shirt right side out and ironed that side of it as well. Both sides need to be ironed. And you know what? It was that day that I learned that Martha Stewart was not my real mother.
However, you should iron the under part of the button placket.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. The parts that are tough to get nice and smooth, iron the other side of that for sure.
Yes.
But do not listen. Do not go to the bother of ironing both sides inside out. That's ain't nobody got time for that.
Yeah.
Get yourself a really good quality iron.
Hmm.
Our old iron broke. I don't know. That's about 5-6 years ago, we had an iron for like 20 years. It was the iron I brought to the relationship, I think, as well.
I believe it was.
Yes. And it finally gave up the ghost. It was an old Black & Decker, you know. And it died, and I thought, you know what I hate more than anything in life is buying appliances. I should only have to buy one appliance of any given thing, and it should last me until I'm dead. That is what I believe. So when confronted with the need to buy an appliance, I think, what is the best one that I can afford? I'm going to go get that one. And I decided in that moment that we had a little wiggle money that month. And I was going to go get a Rowenta Steemium. Rowenta is the brand. The Steemium.
This sounds like a Harry Potter, like...
It is. The Steemium was...
Spell Rowenta Steemium.
Oh. I cannot tell you. I love my Rowenta Steemium so much. It will knock out all the wrinkles of whatever it is you want to iron.
You clean that iron.
I clean that iron with the little goop that you buy. Flawless is the name of the brand. You buy it at any store. You squirt the goop on the rag and you iron the rag and it gets all the gunk off the iron. I clean that damn iron.
But now what do you watch while ironing?
Wendy Williams?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or Are You the One, the dating show on MTV.
Mm-hmm.
Or Desus and Mero.
Mm-hmm.
I watch them while I iron.
I'll tell you.
To iron by are tougher, though.
I was going to go this whole episode without mentioning them.
Yeah.
But I have always said...
Don't.
No. It is actually relevant to this conversation.
All right.
One of the upsides to the Hallmark Christmas movie is that they are designed to be the thing you are paying the third most attention to. You can be ironing and looking at your phone and still completely follow what's going on in the movie. That is the level of cinematic attention required.
Hurricane Heist.
It all comes back.
Please watch Hurricane Heist. While ironing. Please watch also Piranha 3D while ironing.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Ben and Arthur?
No. No, that's a garbage. That's a punishment film. That's not even a fun bad movie. It's just
You're right. You don't iron watch that one. You watch it with other people, at least.
The
There's a new Blu-ray of Mark Hamill and Annie Potts in Corvette Summer.
Corvette Summer? That's a good ironing movie.
That's a good ironing movie.
Although I saw that in the theater when it came out.
Oh, God, really?
Well, my dad took me to see it.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Thursday nights was our dad. That was our dad's visitation night.
Right.
You know,
you go see Cheaper to Keeper.
And we would go see any crap movie that was playing at the Plains Theater.
Mm-hmm.
In downtown Roswell, New Mexico. It's just now the UFO Museum.
Nice.
I saw Corvette Summer there with my dad. And I remember thinking it was pretty boring.
That was a first friend with HBO movie for me.
Yeah. Anything that you've seen before, obviously.
Oh, totally. Yes.
Anything you think is dumb that you like watching anyway? You know, Spice World is a good ironing
movie. Oh, totally. Yeah.
What else? Anyone else have any good record? Do listeners help Ruben with ironing movies?
To what movies do you like to iron? Let us know. Linoleum Podcast.
Because I just watch dumb TV shows while I'm ironing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Reality television is perfect for ironing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You do not want to be paying too much attention to any of that. So, for sure. All right, that's our episode. Thanks for listening. Check out ChristyLemire.com. Listen to Bibbs and Whitney's three shows. I've been saying this all wrong along.
Oh.
They've got Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed and The Two Shot.
Oh, that's right.
All living over at Schmoes Know. And of course, listen to The Schmoes Know. They're lovely. Check out Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark, Sewers of Paris, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Waiting to Exhale. And you can subscribe to this show for free on Apple Podcasts and leave us a positive review. It does help greatly. You can also leave positive feedback on all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com and Spotify and Google Play. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Go visit him at Bluetopia, BLEUTOPIA.com. And again, you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com, and you can follow our Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife. And if you already are doing that, you're the greatest person who ever drew breath.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be back next time. I'll be done with Outfest and have a life again. But until then,
goodbye.